This is the Thirsty Developer, episode number 61 for May 4th, 2009. I got nothing.
This week on the Thirsty Developer, we have a very special episode. Larry's going to interview Dave about the recent project work that he did in Redmond for Project Meba. Let's listen to the interview. First of all, we have to talk about why the episode is called I Got Nothing.
I Got Nothing.
So there's a little running joke between you and I that sometimes we'll have trouble getting a hold of each other. And, you know, if I have to call you a couple, three times during the day, you know, dodging in between meetings, you know, when I first called you in the morning, I knew what I wanted to talk to you about.
That's right.
But then when I finally got a hold of you, you'd say, yeah, what'd you want? And I'll just kind of pause and go, oh, I got nothing. So it's kind of a running joke with us, but for this episode of The Thirsty Developer, I literally got nothing. Normally, we like to record some shows ahead of time,
yep.
Right? Or at least have a plan for when we have a show that comes out on Monday, and we like to publish a show every Monday, that the previous Tuesday or Thursday or Wednesday that we'll record something.
Yeah.
We've been, both you and I have been just absolutely swamped.
Yep.
So we got nothing. You got nobody recorded.
You're just a maniac at this because you want to post a show every single week. And the funny thing is that I know people like download the show, but do they care if it's not there that week? You know.
Actually, I have noticed, and I've heard this from other podcasts as well, that when you skip a week, you lose a little bit of audience.
Yeah.
And you know, we're not trying to like, you know, be the next Leo Laporte, you know, or Scott Hanselman or Carl Franklin.
Because I do have my listening patterns. Because you know, Mondays, you know, I'm listening to This Week in Tech or Windows Weekly, Indignation, all those other shows. You know, so I do have my own listening patterns. But I'm always kind of concerned. Is like, not a concern, but just wondering. You know, for a Thirsty Developer, do people? Are they happy that there's a weekly episode?
I think so, because I've actually I did an event on a Tuesday in Chicago. So an in-person event, and I mentioned the Thirsty Developer. I said, you know, does anybody listen to the show? And somebody raised their hand and said, yeah, I listened to the show that you published yesterday. So that there are people who are downloading it immediately. You know, we don't get any emails. Well, we don't get any emails, period. Please email us at thirstydeveloper@live.com sometime. Let us know you're there. We don't get any emails from somebody irate that we missed a week.
Yeah.
But I do know that people will listen to the show when it's there.
Right.
And that's why we were early on, we really didn't have a cadence.
Right.
And I said, let's just do it on Monday because that's just, you know, it's easier for me to edit the show on Sunday or whatever.
Right.
So.
Because it takes a lot of time to put these together. I mean, I don't think it's the time putting them together because essentially push the record button and just a couple edits here and there for people saying stuff they're not supposed to say or something maybe. Not too often does that happen, but just hit the record button, push it to the computer, and just push it out onto the feed, and you're ready to go. But I think the hardest part is just finding people to talk to. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that. It's not finding people to talk to.
Until this week, we never had a problem with that.
Yeah. Well, it's also, I mean, we talked about this. We said that we have to find a way to do remote interviews and make that happen. And we want to make sure that the quality's there before we do it. So we kind of talked about different things like, you know, trying to do Skype and actually make it easier on the people on the other end that we're interviewing. So they don't have to, you know, do we have to ship them a microphone, a recording kit, or this and that and get kind of crazy with it? I don't think so. Or do we set up some sort of phone recording system or utilizing Skype? But we got to do some investigation to see how that's going to happen.
And, yeah, we're going to do some research over that, you know, especially with the summer coming up. Evangelism load lightens up a little bit because the people that we talk to are on vacation. We don't plan as many events.
Microsoft's end of fiscal year as well.
Yeah. So we'll have a little time to research that. I want to make sure that when we say, hey, we're live for remote recording, that we can record anybody in the world.
Right. Like Chicago Code Camp is coming up. Rhea Palooza is coming up this week. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to make it up to Fox Valley Day of .NET. That would have been a great place to talk to some people. The Indie Code Camp is coming up as well. So these are events in our area. But what I would like to do is, you know, interview people elsewhere as well, you know, not just within sort of our area and the people that we work with, you know, quite often, but just, you know, meeting other people out, you know, sort of in the world that we're not getting a chance to talk to, people that are passionate about what they're doing, passionate about technologies, and just kind of sharing that and just having a discussion around it.
So you mentioned the events that we've got coming up. So this will be the only week, I think, that, you know, we got nothing from a show standpoint.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we do have Rhea Palooza this week. I'm at Tech Ed next week.
Oh, that's right.
I do already have an interview scheduled for this Tuesday that we'll probably have, you know, next Monday, yeah. Right? So we've got some interview opportunities coming up. So I think that we're going to build.
I keep forgetting TechEd's coming up.
Yeah, it's just around the corner.
I know, literally.
And I'm doing a presentation with Wade Wegner there.
Yep.
Yeah, this week we've got to finish up the presentation, right? We know exactly the messages we're trying to do. We know the presentation, but we want to have the killer demo.
The killer demo.
Yeah. Or demos actually. So
if you've never presented before, that's hard.
I presented before, Dave. Yeah. Oh, you're talking about somebody listening. Oh, okay.
What I'm saying is, you know, presenting in front of people to me, and that's probably just because of my personality and everything else, to me is the easy part. It's finding the cool demos that's really going to get your message across without getting lost in the whiz-bang of the demo. That's the hard part.
Well, there are three or four things that are very hard about the great demo.
Yeah.
And one of which is exactly what you said, that, you know, it conveys your message. You don't want a lot of bling and a lot of eye candy getting in the way of the underlying technology. You want to show code, but you don't want to show too much code.
Right.
And there's a lot of people that give criticism about Microsoft Evangelist and how they present. When I'm writing code, I do unit tests all the time. I do error handling all the time. When I'm doing a demo, though, that can kind of get in the way of what you're showing. So you want to make sure. Yeah. I've taken upon myself to make sure that I show people that, hey, I've got a full set of unit tests here, right? So they're there. I don't want to spend three quarters of my presentation going through the unit tests.
Yeah.
But they exist.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, you know, last week, I forgot the guy's name. Is it Jim?
Jim Holmes.
Frazzledad, right?
Yeah.
Jim Holmes. So Jeff Blankenberg, who he knows Jim Holmes and worked with him, sent out an email to the rest of the evangelism team saying, hey, Jim Holmes just posted this, kind of doing a call out essentially call out to the evangelist saying, hey, you're not showing demos the right way. Or maybe, you should be showing things like unit tests and stuff like that, which I completely agree. The problem is, like you said,
it can get in the way.
And the unfortunate thing is, you know, when you only have an hour to present, an hour to talk about something, and you're talking about something that maybe doesn't have to do with unit tests, you can certainly bring up and says, yeah, you would want to write a unit test around this, and maybe this is what it would look like. And, you know, if you post the code, you can post it with the unit test. But during the discussion, it's very difficult to kind of change focus or change your attention to talk about why this thing exists here.
So you also hit on the other thing that makes a demo so hard, being able to give people the demo afterwards and to have it to be easy to run.
Right.
I like to create all of my demos from scratch. Occasionally I'll use corp demos. They never work out too well for me. When I know the code inside and out, I know things work. It's always better, right?
Yeah.
I ran into this recently that I did a presentation for a local user group, and I've used the same demo a couple of different times. You know, when we were in Decatur a couple of weeks ago, I showed the same one, and you were in the room.
Yeah.
One of the things that made it so difficult is...
Wait, so this demo, why don't you explain it first? It's
an ADO.NET data service that gets called a couple of different ways via different client front-end stuff. And I'm going to post it out on my blog someplace.
Like using jQuery and just client-side, different client-side technologies, Silverlight, and Collins over that back-end data. How do you pull data from a client?
When I was creating the demo, I was going to use the SQL Server 2008 spatial data types, right? There's the geometry and geospatial data types,
right?
And I was like, wow, I'm showing longitude and latitude in here. It'd be perfect, right? I started thinking, wait a second, there's probably a percentage of the people that are going to see this that aren't running SQL Server 2008
yet. They have no idea what that is.
Well, it doesn't matter that if they have no idea what it is. If I give them the code, if I give them the database afterwards because they're not running it, it's going to be worthless to them. So I intentionally, instead of using those specific data types, I actually just plugged the long and lat column of the database so it would run on SQL Server 2000, SQL Server 2005. And I know some people would probably be critical of that. It's like, well, you should be showing the latest and greatest technology. I want something that's really accessible for people to go back and use.
And what we have to be careful of is that when we do provide that demo code, because you have to realize there's going to be a good majority of your audience that grabs on that demo code that's going to be doing cut and paste. So you want to make sure that whatever you're providing is kind of the correct, I don't know if correct is the right word, or a good way or best practice way of doing it, because there's, once again, you look at the problem at hand, and there's probably so many ways of sort of solving that problem that you want to make sure that whatever code you're providing is sufficient enough that it's promoting good code practices.
or at least not monumentally bad coding practices.
Yeah, exactly.
That's like the low bar.
Exactly.
So, Dave, we talked about a lot of things here, ramping up to some questions I want to ask you. But there's one thing that I do want to cover, and that I think that we ought to just periodically, like once a month, do this. Let's talk about what the Thirsty Developer is all about. Because we haven't said in a while.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, the kind of purpose of the show.
Yep.
We want it to be different from other podcasts.
Right.
You and I are evangelists for Microsoft.
Yep.
But this is not an official Microsoft podcast.
Yeah, we don't want to make it about that.
Right. You don't want to, you know, you can't go to Microsoft.com/podcast and get all of our shows and all that. This is about things that Dave and I think are cool.
Yeah. Well, essentially, it all started, right? You know, going back to the story, is like, you know, after a code camp or a tech ed or PDC or something like that, you know, people typically gravitate to the bar, grab some cocktails. They sit around and kind of just talk about kind of what we like to talk about technology and about programming, about architectural decisions, and just, you know, it's our careers, right? It's
right.
It's what everybody knows. It's a common topic. So it's like, you know, grab some beers, have a conversation about technical topics, and that's exactly what it was. It's like, because we're evangelists, we have an opportunity to meet so many different people, so many different interesting people that are doing some interesting things with the technology.
And go so many different places as part of our job.
Yeah.
Most people don't have the luxury of that.
That's right.
As a result of this, we're hearing some great conversations.
Yeah.
And the purpose of the Thirsty Developer was, let's hit the record button. Let's ask permission. We're not voyeurs.
No. There's no... We should start doing like a covert recordings.
Oh no. But you know, we want to ask people, it's like, hey, this is a great conversation. Can we record it?
Right.
And we know so many smart people that we meet day in, day out that we always have the opportunity to record these great stories.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, you've said it before and I'll say it now. This is the most fun that I have as a Microsoft
evangelist.
Especially
those first episodes.
Oh geez. Yeah.
We never left so damn hard.
Yeah, that was, let's say the blooper reel was longer than the interviews.
Yeah.
So, Dave, our guest interview for this week is yourself.
I don't want to be a guest. I kind of like this. I kind of like just talking.
Well, I'm going to ask you some questions, though.
All right.
In January of this year, you started on a project, a temporary assignment for Microsoft.
What I like to call my work release program.
Your work release program, yes. That what you did is that you got associated with a project that's kind of ongoing, you know, up in Redmond, to bring to light some of the new features of our cloud computing platform in such a way that it's very friendly for business-to-business applications.
Yeah, it was essentially taking a business problem and figuring, you know, it seemed like the business problem fit well with sort of our cloud computing initiative, you know, specifically the .NET services side. So just to give you some a quick background on it, it was... Through the efforts of Jack Greenfield specifically, who's part of the platform architecture team at what is affectionately known as DPE Corp, you know, Development Platform Evangelism in Redmond, sort of late 90s, you really heard the term B2B like everywhere.
Right.
That was the term de facto. That was like sort of the buzzword of the day. You know, before Web 2.0, before SOA, before all that, it was B2B.
Right. And you know, it's interesting that in 1999, I wrote an article for ASP Today. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That site? Talking about doing B2B transactions with XML.
Right.
I wonder if there's still a copy of that floating in the internet.
Of course there is.
If there is, I will put a link into the show notes so you guys can see this article that I wrote.
Go back to archive.org and find it, right?
Maybe. Don't know.
Unless it's behind some sort of paid content thing or something.
Well, it was funny that at the time that I wrote it, it was free. ASP Today wasn't a subscription membership. And then about a year after I wrote that article, it became a paid subscription kind of site. So
it'll
be interesting. I'll see if I can find it.
Yeah.
And if it's there, I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
And no laughing when you guys read the article. It is 10 years old now.
Exactly.
So.
Well, it'd be interesting, though, because I'm sure a lot of the sort of thoughts and the practices behind that still are valid. They still exist.
Actually, the mistake I made, it was very, I would say that I was doing REST before REST was cool, before REST was actually titled, you know, in the article.
Mm-hmm.
My example was way too simplistic, and I was supposed to write a second article for it that was a more complex version. And it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
What happened is the editor left or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's... But anyway, B2B was hot.
Yep.
You know, I was on that train, you know, back in the 90s.
Yep.
But in some ways, it's a problem we haven't completely solved.
Yeah.
Because if you look at business-to-consumer applications, there's plenty of great examples of that all over the internet, right?
Right. There's a UI. UI that the user interacts with. When you talk B2B, it's usually back-end systems communicating for in sort of an automatic way.
But when I worked in enterprise before coming, not enterprise, you know, the company or the Starship, but when I worked in enterprise computing before coming to Microsoft, that was the hardest thing that you did was it was application to application integration was tough enough within your own data center. But the second you looked at, you know, hey, we're going to send transactions to this company and they're going to do X for us and they're going to send transactions back to us. Anytime you created a partnership with a third party company, and it cost you literally hundreds of thousands of dollars to get this integration done. Because a lot of the tooling that's there for application to application or for business to consumer applications just isn't there in the B2B space.
Mm-hmm.
Hence Project Meeba. Can we say Meeba? Are we allowed? Is that internal code name?
Oh, I don't know. It's all over the place. Project Meeba is all over the place.
And Meeba stands for?
So Meeba stands for Multi-Enterprise Business Applications. It's not like a cool, you know, nickname of anything. It's actually, you know, an anagram of something, you know. That is an anagram, right? I don't know.
No, it's not an anagram. It's an acronym.
That's what I knew it was an A something. You know what? We just got, you know, done with a long drive. I'm tired.
We got our blooper, though, if we choose to cut that out.
No, leave it in. Leave it in. Yeah, so the Project Meeba thing, what it was is that, you know, Jack had this vision of...
And you mentioned Jack Greenfield earlier, and now you made a second reference to him.
Yeah.
This is the Jack Greenfield.
Oh, Mr. Software Factories.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, Jack Greenfield was...
I used to read his stuff back in the day.
He was apparently the... You know, he worked with the Gang of Four and apparently was their manager back in, you know, the days of IBM and worked with Steve Jobs and the next computer company that Steve Jobs had. And
does he have a blog?
He has a history. Unfortunately, he does, but he hasn't updated in a while. And I told him, I said, Jack, you got a lot of great sort of anecdotes and sort of stories. I said, you need to get back at that. And he's like, yeah. But if you saw this man's inbox, you'd understand why he doesn't have time to blog. He's a busy man. I mean, he's currently writing another book, so he's sort of taking up his time with that. But
so Jack was the project sponsor for me?
Yeah, he was. Well, he's the vision. He was the visionary for the project. Okay. I mean, this is Jack's idea, and sort of he was trying to pull together different resources to make it happen. So essentially the idea was, if you look at B2B, one of the complexities of B2B, well, really probably the most complex and most costly thing about B2B is sort of setting up the infrastructure. The infrastructure that makes, that allows, you know, companies to talk to other companies electronically. And then the second part of the complexity is, what are they talking? What are they sending back? You've got these different organizations and consortiums together that put together specifications around what different messages should exist or should, what are the messages that should be sending across the wire that both of them can communicate. And you have things like EDI, and I guess EDI is like, I'm not an EDI person, but I guess EDI is a big mess and you don't necessarily know what you're going to get. And there's a lot of not all EDI is the same, and you have to do specific customizations to make it work once you integrate it into your enterprise system.
Yeah. And I can talk a little of this. EDI, the concept is great, right? That we're going to have a common format that we both understand. The issues that you ran into with EDI is that they would standardize on them, but the standards allowed for a lot of flexibility. So what would happen is that if you were a company and I was a company, we can't just say, hey, I speak EDI 810, which is the invoice transaction, as I recall, right? Okay. What we have to do is we say, oh, we both do 810. Which book do you use? Because it was actually books published by different segments. It was a retail book.
Right.
And then you have to say which version of the retail book. And even then, when you got down to, okay, there's a specific transaction code in there for shipping, you would say what code you used, and I would program against that.
Right.
So when you sent me one that said ON, I knew that was overnight.
Right.
Somebody else would send me FX because they were going to send that overnight transaction via Federal Express.
Okay.
You could see how
it's different.
Roughly, you know, when you look at an 810 transaction, you know what the major fields are. The issue is that you had to have this, I used to call it chatter.
Right.
That somebody, you know, on both sides had to talk with each other, and it didn't take a lot of time. But if you look at companies that do business with a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
even if it only takes, you know, a couple of days to set up an EDI transaction with one vendor, what if you have 1,000 vendors?
And I actually had that situation. I was on a project back in my consulting days for a logistics company. So essentially their job is that, you know, Motorola needs to ship cell phone parts from Japan to the U.S. They take care of that process.
Right.
So they literally had thousands of customers that they were doing logistics shipping and packaging and all kinds of things for. And I remember there was one guy that they brought in from Germany, of all places. He was the EDI guy, and his job was to do those conversions, and that's all he did, is to just to map whatever was coming into the system that we were building.
And in most companies of any size, there's two or three of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
The EDI expert kind of things. And EDI does pay for itself if you look at the number of transactions that companies send back and forth. It's not like you send one or two of these a day where you could say, I could do these things manually.
Right.
This is like, you know, you're getting hundreds of these in and out every day, so you want the stuff to flow through.
Right, right.
EDI or X12, it was often criticized that people say, oh, well, the problem with it is the format is, you know, more line-oriented. And they say, oh, well, if we just go to XML, this will solve all the problem.
Right.
And there are a lot of consortiums, you know, industry groups that have gone to XML.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't solve the problem of we have no standard definition for what's in that field.
Yeah, and that actually, so what actually I learned from this project was the first things that we started doing is sort of investigating what was out there. And, you know, Jack already, you know, had some of this, in his back pocket, and he kind of pointed me in the right direction in the sense that, you know, there's something called UMM, which is kind of like UML. But essentially what this was defined by a group within the United Nations, of all places. So this is trying to define a base standard to help you define those standards for any type of electronic business.
A standard for standards?
A standard for standards. So essentially what it was, it was a meta model. And I'm not a UML guy by any stretch of the imagination, but it was a meta model to help you define what those models were to do electronic business. You know, for global impact, right? This is United Nations, right? That's defining this. And so, out of that, what has grown out of that is something called like EBXML, which is together with the United Nations as well as Oasis.org. They got together, start defining what these models are. And part of these models is also the messages and what the messages look like out of these models. So what you do is you model sort of the business, what they call business collaborations and business transactions and everything else. So like as an example, and actually I blogged about this a little bit, is an example that we would latch onto was there's a business process called request order from quote or something like that, right?
Okay.
And there's really two sort of main business transactions that fall into that category. One is I'm requesting a quote from a seller and then I receive a quote and then I have an opportunity to purchase that with that quote. So
okay.
those are two different business transactions. And requesting a quote, there could be many different things, many different sort of messages being sent back and forth. One is I'm sending a message over across to request a quote for this particular product. And now, as a responder, they're going to do a process on their end called calculate quote. And so what they'll do is you send the message, and they'll send an acknowledgement back. So there's kind of like an asynchronous thing going on where they're still calculating something, and when they're done, they'll send the message back to you. First, they got to say, "Hey, we acknowledge that we received your request," and they set up like an SLA agreement, and this is all defined as part of the models and everything. There's an agreement that says we promise to provide you a quote within, say, 10 minutes.
Right.
Right. Or then it's an invalid request or something along those lines. You start going through all these processes about sending messages back and forth, acknowledging the messages, and then getting your information back and then making business decisions on what you want to do with that information. Okay, now I want to purchase the order. Now you purchase the order based upon this quote, and maybe now there's a creditor that's involved. So now you got to send a message to a creditor and sort of get the credit information and maybe a PO and everything else. So there's a lot of different sort of, there's lots of messages that are all part of this one big collaboration.
Coordination. A lot of coordination going on.
Yep. Absolutely. And so what UMM does is it sort of defines that modeling language that you use to define, you know, so you're in the end case, like EBMXML, you're modeling out that whole business collaboration and coordination.
Mm-hmm.
And so out of that, you're going to define a number of different things. You're going to define endpoints. Because endpoints are going to be receiving and sending information. You're going to be defining the messages that are going back and forth and what they contain. So out of that, you have your full-on business transaction. So what we were trying to do with this information is, okay, now let's build a sort of a B2B community, if you will. And there's really serving two purposes. One I talked about earlier about the, you know, B2B transactions, one of the complexities is really the cost of the infrastructure. So let's use .NET services.
Right.
Let's use the Internet Services Bus to provide that sort of that channel to have the communications going back and forth. So we're building this communication network on top of a scalable infrastructure that's cost-effective, that handles internet standards to do internet communication back and forth, so different secure transactions and transactional and everything else. And then also what we're building out of this is a B2B community. So if I'm sort of a business that's looking for business partners, because when we talk up with the different companies about, you know, what they would like to see from this, you know, one of the things that's hard for them is just trying to find other people that support these business collaborations.
Discovery,
right? Exactly.
When we first launched web services as an industry 10 years ago, that was like, you know, this unbelievably nebulous cloud of how do you find these, you know, web services to call?
Right, exactly. So Jack's vision was, you know, he wanted to kind of throw in a social computing component into this, and the idea was that businesses would join this community to find business partners and to also to essentially advertise, to say, hey, I support this business collaboration.
And you know,
I'm playing the role of a buyer. I'm looking for people who are support this business collaboration. They're playing the role of a seller.
You know what's so cool about that is that really models how actual business gets done.
Right.
Because I'll tell you, you know, as somebody that I network with, you know, we go to the same club, we go to the same church, whatever. You know, I'll say, you know, yeah, I'm looking to, you know, have somebody do X for my business, right? I'm looking, you know, to add T-shirts to my line. People go, oh, yeah, I got a T-shirt guy that I use. We really love him. You know, he does great quality work. Or I've got a cousin that does that. You know, you should talk to
this
person.
Somebody already had. Or somebody always has a cousin that does that.
Yeah.
Well, so just, you know, so the whole Project Meba thing, what we were doing is one, we were building kind of this portal website built on top of ASP.NET MVC to support this community. And this is actually sort of work that was already derived from another project within the platform architecture team. And what I was sort of responsible for, or working on, I guess I should say, is sort of that back end piece. How do we tie it? How do we integrate the back-end piece of where we're utilizing .NET services to do that communication back and forth? And so it was actually it was very interesting and kind of challenging in the sense that, you know, of course, this is Azure, so things are changing daily almost. It seems like, you know, that, you know, they're saying, oh, we're going to do different, they're releasing different SDKs and different systems into the actual cloud, if you will.
But and when you say Azure, you're talking about the Azure Services Platform,
that's right.
Which has four major components in it. Each one with its own SDK and its own time schedule. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get updates right now because the platform itself is maturing.
Yep.
You know, as we're looking at it, right? You get updates at different times.
Right.
You know, for instance, the .NET services that you mentioned, that was updated in March.
Yep.
I just got an update to live services and the mesh client 2 days ago.
Yep.
You know, at the beginning of May.
Right.
So, and I think it's a good thing that they're churning separately right now, but at some point they'll get on a, you know, I think they'll get on a little more stable release cycle as they get dependencies between the different parts of the platform.
Yeah, and what we were trying to do is, like, you know, you look at .NET services and there's the workflow component. So what we were trying to do is we were trying to take that workflow piece and we were actually trying to sort of model out that workflow that would resemble the actual business collaboration itself. So as you're kind of walking down the workflow, it
Modeled in the UMM to tie it back together?
Yeah,
okay.
So what we're trying to do is if you have a UMM model, right? UMM model is something that's a specific standard. So you should be able to take that UMM model and read it electronically. And what we would like to do, and it hasn't happened yet, and I'm not sure if it will, but what we'd like to do is take that UMM model that some sort of, you know, organization has defined as part of, say, you know, because EBXML is defining all these different standards based upon UMM about how to do electronic business.
Yep.
So take this UMM model that's defined and then convert that actually to a workflow for .NET services. And essentially what it becomes a message workflow. This message input, this message output, you know, that kind of thing. And so we were looking at things like that, but we were also looking at, you know, utilizing what does the .NET service bus do for us, right? So, like, you know, if you got systems that are behind firewalls, well, the .NET service bus, you know, works its magic where I can connect to, like, an endpoint up in a cloud through utilizing standard protocols, through standard ports, and get through firewalls, and then be able to communicate with another system that kind of goes up into the cloud. And we can kind of do it does a binding for us up in the cloud for us to be able to send those messages back and forth.
Yeah, and that's really important because if you look at how business is done without something like that present, it's generally over an expensive leased line.
Mm-hmm.
and lease lines or value-added networks, you know, which is a kind of an EDI artifact, right? Any one lease line is pretty cheap, and you can do them now with internet VPNs. The problem, again, goes back to scale. I'm harping on that, right? It's like Dave and Larry doing business together over a lease line or a configured VPN where we're doing shared keys. Not an issue. Do that 1,000 times, and it starts becoming an issue.
Right. And so, you know, we're taking advantage of the workflow component. We're taking advantage of the .NET services bus, and sort of that third piece, and the one that, once again, not my strong suit or have a background in, but is the access control service. We started to talk about tokens and security tokens and what that exactly means, and you know, public and private keys, and you know, what was great for me is that a lot of the stuff that we were talking about was all new to me.
Right.
And I love opportunities like that because, you know, when I was a consultant, the reason I became a consultant is because I got to do so many different things and learn so many different things and work on so many different projects. But what sort of started happening at the end of my sort of consulting career was that I started doing the same thing just in a different location.
Right.
And it wasn't as challenging anymore. You know, you're doing sort of the same thing over and over. And so it wasn't as exciting for me anymore. So this opportunity, going out and working in Redmond and working with product teams and working with the platform architecture team, is here's a business problem. Here's this brand new technology, old business problem, or semi-old business problem. You know, they haven't really solved this whole B2B thing. But, you know, we have this business problem. We have these brand new technologies. Let's figure out how to make it work. I love those kind of opportunities.
So these business problems, Dave, date back to like 1200 with the first corporations.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
the Dutch East India Trading Company, where this all started.
Yeah.
12 years ago, I actually got to go to Europe, and it was actually in Brussels where all the first corporations were all founded, all in the same square. Literally, I mean, that's kind of...
I had runners back and forth doing their message transactions.
Exactly. I mean, and that's if you looked at the complexities of the long-running transaction that I'm going to buy tea from you, but it's going to be shipped overseas. And by the way, shipping overseas is not like it is today. It's not as reliable.
Yeah.
You know, what happens, you know, when the ship goes down? Who's responsible for that? The buyer?
Or there's a mutiny.
He didn't get his... yeah. Or some catastrophe happens, right? What happens to that? And,
right.
You know, it's certainly not the buyer because he never got his tea. You know, me as a seller, I used somebody else's ship. You know, and that's where insurance came from too.
Right, exactly.
it was after corporations started taking this responsibility for it. So.
I said this 1,000 times. I'll say it again, man. You are just a wealth of just knowledge.
Useless knowledge is what you usually say when we're not recording. So
I didn't say that. You're just a wealth of knowledge.
But it's definitely an old problem that we're trying to solve.
Exactly. Technology and
the shrinking world, as they call it, have accelerated the problem.
I mean, when I think of B2B, I mean, really the late 90s sticks out to me because that's where I first heard the term. And I think more from, you know, how can we utilize this sort of this internet to do transactions from businesses to business and do it, you know, sort of without any human intervention, you know.
Or the human intervention needs to be value added,
right.
Not the non-value added things that, you know, process and systems can do for us.
So, I mean, so looking at Project Meba, the good news is that it was a great experience for me personally. And I try to blog as much about it as possible and still trying to provide some sort of, succinct explanation about what we're doing. And, you know, and I have to be honest with you, when I first got on the project, I'm like, what are we doing? You know, it's kind of like,
what are we doing?
Yeah. I had no clue what UMM was. I had no clue what EBXML was. And just kind of going back to that topic is, you know, we talk about UMM. There's one other thing I wanted to mention was that, you know, we have EBXML, which is a kind of a group that's defining standards for the electronic business. There's also something called HL7, which is taking that same UMM model and defining, extending those models and building new models based upon that for the healthcare industry.
The healthcare industry, yeah.
Yeah, so...
There's also another Accord is another group that's doing the same thing for insurance as a whole.
Right. Yep. So, yeah. So going back to the project, great experience for me. Learned a ton. The unfortunate thing is that this whole project happened during this whole Microsoft announcing, you know, they're going to have layoffs and this and that. And unfortunately, it did affect some of the people that I was working with at the time. And the place was unfortunately kind of a little bit in turmoil, if you will. The project was funded. The project has great funding within other groups within Microsoft, specifically the enterprise business groups and other areas. But the project for a time there really didn't have an owner. Right. It didn't have a team that owned it. It had people that owned it, and those people were just, you know, trying to find a good place, a landing place for the project. And so we'll kind of see. We'll see what happens. I mean, that kind of give it, it was a little speed bump in our project, but I mean that happens with every single project. I don't, you know, but it was a great opportunity. Worked with some great people. One of the things that was challenging for me was we actually had a team in India, and kind of, you know, my role in the project was supposed to be dev lead, and it really kind of turned into dev lead slash program manager.
And, slash architect, too.
Slash architect. Well, yeah, kind of.
Sorry, the stuff you were describing, Dave, that's architecture.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, so it was architect. So we had a team in India of about, there was three individuals in India that we were working with, and great people, great developers. They did a great job. It was a little tough because the collaboration standpoint, for whatever reason, is they couldn't install, like, you know, any sort of messaging programs like, you know, Windows Live Messenger or anything for that matter, or even Google Talk on their networks just from a security standpoint. So I couldn't just send them quick chat sessions back and forth, you know.
So everything was a scheduled call?
Everything was a scheduled call. You'd try to shoot off emails. You didn't necessarily know if you're going to get a response. And because of the time difference, it was literally a 12.5-hour time difference or 10.5-hour time difference, depending on whether I was in Chicago or if I was out in Seattle. You know, having late night meetings and everything. So it was a bit of a challenge in that regard. So it was unfortunate because you're during the day, it's like, oh, how are we going to do this part? How are we going to figure this out? And it's like you want somebody there with you to kind of talk about it, get on the whiteboard, map it out. How's it going to work? As opposed to like, oh, we have to wait for tonight's call to discuss that.
Because I've worked, you know, with offshore teams before, and there's two ways that it generally lands. It lands that the time difference just totally blows productivity.
Yep.
Or there's actually some situations where it can really enhance productivity. And,
well, yeah, you could be programming 24/7.
Well, not only programming 24/7, but what's interesting is that if you have onshore resources doing UAT, yeah, and you have offshore resources doing the fixes,
yeah,
you can literally get things fixed in one day.
Yeah.
You know, if you find a bug at 4 o'clock, you file it, you come back the next morning, it's fixed.
Yeah,
it can be a real time boost, or it can be like, you know, like you said, like, oh, it's noon.
Right. Unfortunately, this time I think
our team is asleep.
Yeah, we were doing more requirements gathering than anything, I think.
Yeah,
more of the planning and trying to figure out what is it that we're going to build, what's it going to look like, how's it going to work, and in those cases, you really want like a team that, like I said, let's lock ourselves in a room, let's get a whiteboard, let's sort of map these things out. You know, can we do this with .NET services? Can we do this with access control service? Does workflow provide us the necessary activities to make this work? And sort of hashing out those ideas. And the problem is like you sort of think about these during the day. And it's like, oh, I got to wait to discuss this with my team now for another 9 hours, you know, or something.
Yeah, I think sometimes the real productivity hit is that when you're talking to them, it's either late at night for them or late at night for you.
Exactly.
So somebody wants to go to bed.
That's right. Exactly. So, and also because it was all phone too, they didn't have a video camera on their side. It, you know, you couldn't see their facial expressions or did they understand the question or.
Oh, that's so tough.
Yeah.
I mean, even across the United States, that's tough.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Exactly. But, no, it was, you know, it was a great experience. I was out there for, I don't know what, 2.5 months or so. I mean, essentially, you know, my manager gave me an opportunity, Brian Moore, thank you very much, for allowing me to go out there. And, I mean, since I joined Microsoft, I always kind of wanted an opportunity. I always asked, I go, what it would be nice to do sort of a job share where, you know, we go out and sort of sit with the product teams and try not to bug them too much, but try to provide value that we can sort of bring back to our jobs in the field. You know, unfortunately, there hasn't really been those opportunities that came up. This opportunity happened to come up. And, you know, Wade Wegner did phase one, and he actually had some great output from his project where they actually built a PDC demo. This one, I unfortunately had to leave it at a time that, you know, we were really starting to, you know, get the tires moving and moving forward. And it'll be interesting to see where the project goes after this. And hopefully, you know, we will see the light at the, you know, the end of the day of Project Meepa hitting on the web as some sort of reference case study or something.
Yeah, well, I think it's fantastic that you got all that learning, you know, that knowledge, that firsthand experience, intimate access. I know you talked to Clemens, you know, quite a bit about .NET services and all that, but I'm glad to have you back, Dave.
Thanks, Larry.
and I know the people in, you know, we cover Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana, the local people here have been missing you, the listeners of Thirsty Developer.
No, they're probably like, I don't know. Who's this Dave guy? I don't know who he's talking about.
There were several Twitter messages where people were asking, you know, hey, what's up with Dave Boss? So we tried to answer those questions. And it's good to have you back.
Thanks, man.
Let's wrap up with a different topic. You told me on the way down here, and we didn't tell people that we actually drove to Indianapolis today before we started recording.
Yeah, we could have recorded in the car the whole time. Yeah.
On a Sunday afternoon.
Well, we were actually listening to podcasts and, you know, just kind of in...
Well, we're catching up to it. Yeah, you know, we don't spend... you know, people think we spend too much time together, but we don't get to see each other that much. But you were talking about you've converted over to Windows 7.
Yeah.
RC.
RC, yeah.
Which came out for MSDN and TechNet subscribers about a week ago.
Yeah, I downloaded it on Thursday.
The first day it was available on MSDN and TechNet. It'll be available to the public after we publish the show, like on the 5th, mm-hmm. which will be Tuesday.
Yep.
So everybody should have access to it pretty much by the time you know the show's out there and downloaded onto people's devices and listened to it. Tell me about your upgrade experience, because I haven't done this yet. I'm still running build 7000.
Well, so let's cover a few things there. One, when people if people already downloaded the beta and they got a beta key, and when they download the RC, they don't need a new key. So just reuse the existing key that you have. If you didn't download the Windows 7 beta, then you'll request a key, and we're not limiting the keys this time. We're essentially giving it to whoever wants it, which I think is great. So talk about an upgrade. I actually didn't upgrade. I did a full pave. I was running Windows 7 beta, which was build 7000,
right,
for quite some time, and I was starting to get a little, you know, I had some issues with the beta, and they're mainly more related to IE, because it was a early build of IE that would sort of, you know, kind of lock up, and I have a tendency to open a ton of tabs and do some.
It was a pre-RC version of IE8. It was a really old version of IE8.
Yeah, so I had some performance issues and some lockups and this and that would happen. And I was ready to get off the beta. And so when the RC came, I actually had some opportunities to get some early...
interim builds?
And some interim builds. And, you know, I was kind of a little reluctant. Do I really want to do this? Because I know the RC is going to be coming out soon. Do I want to pave it and this and that? So when the RC came out, I kind of said, okay, I'm ready. And what I, you know, every time I do it, I repave my machine, what's the biggest pain in the butt?
Data.
Is moving, you know, copying my data off, backing it up and everything. So not necessarily just my documents, but more about my music. It's more about Zune. You know, I have the Zune pass, so I can download as much, you know, music as I want when I want, which is great for me because I always like, you know, discovering new music and everything else, but I tend to sort of fill up the hard drive, if you will, with tons and tons of music, and because you're just downloading everything left and right. And well, so what happens when you repave your machine is you don't want to have to sort of go and re-download all that stuff again,
right?
And so you can back it up, but you should kind of tell me a trick about Zune, and maybe we'll kind of get to in a second here. But so it's copying the data. So the first thing that I did is that, you know, we have the Windows Easy Transfer built into the OS. So I ran Windows Easy Transfer, plugged in an external hard drive, and just kind of selected the things. It defaults to certain things to back up, like all your user profile information, your documents, your favorites, and your download section, your music, pictures, videos. It has all that pre-checked for you. But there's also some things that maybe I don't have in that tree, or maybe I don't want everything in that directory tree. So I can go in there and customize what I want.
Like, for instance, if you stored some code, you know, hanging off the root of C.
Exactly.
You know,
like
it wouldn't pick up that.
Like, I have a C workspace directory or something like that. Yeah, so I can go in there and customize that and add that folder. So Windows Easy Transfer, I think it backed up. I did not back up my music because I was going to use this Zune trick.
Because you heard about Larry's trick.
Yeah, Larry's trick. And so that saved me 20 gigs of, 18 gigs of data right there that I did not have to copy over. So I think I had like a total of like 26 and a half gig that I had to copy over to an external hard drive. And it took half hour maybe,
right.
somewhere around there, half hour. And so as soon as I did that, I was comfortable. And I was like, okay, all my data is backed up and I can get access to it. And just blew the machine away and booted right up into the Windows 7 install disk and installed it. And I actually made one mistake where I had to download Windows 7 again. My mistake was that I downloaded the x86.
And you wanted the 64-bit.
And I wanted the 64-bit because this was going on my Dell M1330, which is 64-bit. But I have another laptop that is not 64-bit.
So you needed it anyway.
So I needed it anyway. So I installed it once, but I had to install it again because I wanted to install 64-bit. And it was painless. It took 15, 20 minutes maybe to install, and it was a very smooth process. The sort of the biggest challenge for me, and a lot of people at Microsoft, is probably just getting your computer on the domain when you're not in the office.
Right.
So what you have to do is you have to go through like you get your computer all set up and ready to go, and you create a user ID, you know, Dave, who's the administrator of the machine. Now I need to download some sort of VPN connection software to connect up to the Microsoft corporate network so I can add my computer to the domain. And then what my computer is actually in a trial process of this direct access technology that we have, where I essentially stick my smart card in there and I'm connected to the corporate network at all times.
Right.
I don't have to.
And that's a feature of Windows 7 with Windows Server 2008 R2 on the back end and some other things that you need to do. But that's super cool, and I'm not on it, but you are.
Which means that I'm on the corporate network at all times, and so now I have to kind of be careful what I'm doing at all times.
Oh, let's not go there. Yeah, I know several of our colleagues are on that. I'm letting you guys blaze the trail. And when you guys tell me, it's good, then I'll jump on it.
No, it works great. I mean, so the thing that you do is you have to – it gets kind of tricky. Is you have to add – once you add your machine to the domain, and then you kind of take that user ID and add it to the administrator account and stuff. But if you look at the install process, it was fantastic, because during the install, it actually recognized that, hey, there's a wireless network here. Do you want to connect to it? Is this your network connection? Why, yes, it is. Of course it is. And then so you enter your security passcodes and everything. And I know with Vista, Vista was tricky at first for the Dell M1330, because you actually had to install a disk driver, of all things.
Yeah, pre-SP1, there was a disk driver you needed.
Prior to installing Vista, which, you know, if you installed Vista just by Vista, it would blue screen because of this disk driver that needed. But if you use the disk driver prior to the installation, you know, during the installation, you could say,
we've confused everybody.
Install driver. It doesn't matter. Yeah, we've confused everybody. But anyways.
Yes, and we both have the same laptop.
Yeah, there's problems.
Yet another reason that people talk funny about us. Like, oh, Dave and Larry, they even have the same laptop.
But when Vista came out, there was, you know, the installation wasn't up to date with our hardware, whereas now it's a piece of cake. I mean, like I said, it took like 15, 20 minutes. It recognized everything. It created my user IDs for me. And there's one cool thing that I found in the RC that kind of blew my mind, is that there's some new backgrounds in there that are just psychedelic.
We'll have to put a screenshot in the show notes. So
exactly, there's some pretty amazing background art that they have, and some different interesting things they got going on. But I'm loving it; it's great.
So do you want to share the Zune tip for the music?
Why don't you know the Zune tip better than I do?
Okay, so the Zune is basically a hard drive. Right, whether it's a flash one or an actual hard drive, depends on which model you've got. What you can do is, this works with the DRM music that through your Zune Pass or standard MP3 WMA files. You know, it doesn't matter. The music is all there on your Zune if you synced it. So what you do is right before you do the easy transfer that you talked about for all your data and your program settings, you make sure your Zune's, you know, sunk. You know, it's been synced recently. After you reinstall the OS, you install the Zune software that you can get from Zune.net, and then you connect up your Zune, which already has all the music on there from the previous machine, and it'll give you two options of linking the two or connecting as guest. Just say connect as guest. Then you click on device, and then you can actually select all of the music and all the podcasts. And you can copy it over to the computer.
And how do you copy? You have to drag and drop it on the computer, right?
Yeah, you just drag and drop it to the little computer icon.
So highlight all the files.
Right.
You know, the list of files.
Yep.
And then just sort of click on them and drag them down and drop them on top of the computer.
And it actually knows them from the device as songs. So it's not like you're going to some command prompt or whatever. This
is right
through the Zune software.
Yep.
And because you've already, the sync process, put them all on that drive anyway, that's another, like you said, 20, 30 gig of stuff you're not having to copy over. The cool thing is that since there's a podcast on there, it actually has the podcast meta information as well. So when you copy podcast files over there, like thirstydeveloper.com, it'll actually show up under podcast in your collection in the Zune software. And then what you got to do is go and hit subscribe.
Yep.
And you're kind of back to where you started.
Yep.
So it's a little time-saving tip. You know, put a disclaimer on there. You know, it works for me, works on my machine, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So actually what I would do The reason I did it that way is because it was all Zune Pass music.
Right.
I think if it was my own music, I probably would have copied that off separately.
If you couldn't recover it, yeah. make sure you take a backup of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
At some point, but yeah. it's worked for me like half dozen times. Right. So,
out of how many times?
It's worked 100% of the time.
Okay.
So I've done it a half dozen times, both on Windows 7 and Windows Vista.
Yeah.
I repaid my machine a lot.
Nice to have a clean machine sometimes.
I tend to muck things up.
Yeah, and I'm also installing different things. Oh, we also install a lot of beta stuff, a lot of beta tools. And,
well, I'm also very cat in the hat. When something goes wrong, I like have to start over from scratch. I'm like, oh, I saw an error. That's it. I'm repaving the machine.
Do you want to tell that story about your computer speakers?
My computer's... Oh, no. Let's not go there. We'll save that for another show. When you interview me at some point,
we'll do that.
We'll talk about things that have gone wrong in Larry's life. All so right. Should we wrap it up, Dave?
Let's wrap it up, man.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com. Or send us a message on our new Twitter account, twitter.com/thirstyd. This week on The Thirsty Developer, we have a very special episode.
Special.